Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, featured on the ERS Respiratory Channel. My name is Brian Kent. I'm a respiratory and sleep physician at St. James's Hospital in Dublin and an honorary senior lecturer in Trinity College Dublin. I'm also the incoming chief editor of Breathe, the clinical education journal of the ERS. I'm very happy to be leading today's discussion, which will focus on the topic of inhaler adherence in airways disease, why it matters, how we measure it, and what we can do to improve it. Joining me in this discussion are two experts in the field, Gronia Dancona and Imran Suleiman. Gronia is consultant pharmacist for respiratory and sleep medicine at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in London and a senior lecturer at King's College London. Her clinical roles include optimizing care for patients with severe asthma, COPD, interstitial lung disease and sleep disorders, both in the hospital setting and also through virtual clinics in primary care. Her particular area of research interest is in medicines adherence. Imran is a consultant respiratory physician at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin, an honorary lecturer at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, and is adjunct faculty in the Division of Pulmonary, Critical Care and Sleep Medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York. His clinical interests include airways disease, sleep disordered breathing, and point of care ultrasound. His research interests have varied from clinical research, examining inhaler adherence in asthma and COPD, to translational research, helping us better understand host microbial interactions in respiratory disease. Unfortunately, our discussion today is not face to face due to ongoing COVID-19 precautions. So Imran, Gronia, thank you very much for joining us. It would have been nice to have done this in person. So obviously we're here to talk today about adherence to therapy in people who have airways disease and how we look at that and why we look at that and whether it's important. Gronia, I know that you are always at pains to make sure we use the right terminology here. So maybe could you explain to us what we should understand by adherence and why we're not allowed to use other words that to many of us seem like they mean the same thing?
Well, you see, Dr. Kent, that's because you're a physician and you think people should do what they're told. So this idea around compliance is, I think, it's really old hat. It's very much kind of feels like we're telling the patients what to do. They have to do what they're told. And I think we've kind of moved on from that. And I think adherence is the correct term because I think it leaves the judgment at the door. It's a purely a mathematical measure. There's no judgment involved. And I think that that's, you know, the way we should be looking at this. The other word that kind of creeps in occasionally is around describing it as measuring concordance, which again, I just don't think is quite right. I think concordance is more of a measure of a process. And what we're looking at is medicine's use. So I'm very keen that we focus on adherence as a sort of overall overarching term. And then even within kind of adherence, we've got sort of separate facets of that that we might come on to.
So in two sentences or less, can you tell us what adherence means?
So adherence is simply a mathematical measure of how often a patient takes the medicines as have been agreed with their clinician.
So we talk about people being adherent to treatment, but what does that mean? You know, is somebody who takes their medication half of the time adherent to treatment? Is someone who takes their medication 90% of the time adherent to treatment? How do we decide who has good adherence, bad adherence, and somewhere in between?
So I don't think we have agreed on that in airways disease. I think that we have, broadly speaking, agreed that sort of 75 to 80% of doses taken is good adherence. I think any less than that and above 50% is probably suboptimal. I would guess that people need to take more than that to get the maximal benefit. I think anybody's having less than half the doses that we feel they need, that's got to be poor adherence and they're not going to reach the outcomes that we achieve. That hasn't actually been agreed universally. And I think that while that's kind of what we're aiming towards when we move more to sort of biomarker-led outcomes in that way, then I think we probably don't need a number to say, you know, if it's 74%, it's suboptimal, 75%, it's optimal. I think we're much more sophisticated than that. So it's a very roundabout way of saying we're not entirely sure.
Imran, if I could bring you in here, we many moons ago worked together as registrars and we worked for Professor Stephen Lane on a severe asthma service. And I distinctly remember my opinion about adherence changing in 2009 when we were working from because of two things. So first of all, we had a lady who kept coming into the hospital who was supposedly on maintenance oral corticosteroids and swore blind that she was using her treatment on a
regular basis. But if every so often her handbag would fall over and loads of steroids would fall out of it, and it became obvious that she wasn't taking it. And the second thing that happened in that year was that Liam Heaney in Belfast published what to my mind is one of the most important papers in asthma care in the last 15, 20 years in the Blue Journal, where he and his team looked at adherence levels in patients with difficult to severe asthma attending their tertiary referral center. You know, so this whole idea that people will definitely use their medication because they feel a bit sick and the medication will make them feel better. Like, we know now that that doesn't necessarily follow. So can you talk us through a little bit about what we know about levels of adherence in airways disease, you know, particularly in patients with severe asthma and people with COPD?
We know from loads of studies now at this stage using different ways of measuring adherence, whether it's through a dose counter or through an electronic device or through pharmacy refill records, that patients with airways disease are not adherent to their medication. Several meta-analyses at this stage have shown that we're talking about a ballpark figure of about 50% of patients are adherent to their medication. And, you know, to Grania's point, what is good adherence and what is bad adherence? We haven't agreed on what that is. And it's arbitrary, I think, what number we choose, whether it's 50%, 70%, or 80%. We know now from lots of studies that these patients are not adherent to their medications. Most of the work has been really focusing on asthma and inhaler adherence to asthma. And only recently we've been kind of starting to look at data with COPD. And interestingly, the adherence in COPD is even worse than what we published in asthma previously.
There's a lot of different aspects of that to unpick. I'd like to start with addressing whether this is a problem. I mean, are people simply using enough medication to keep themselves well? Like, do we have data to suggest that being poorly adherent to your inhaler leads to worse outcomes?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been studies both in asthma and COPD to show that poor adherence to inhaler medications leads to increased exacerbations, increased presentations to hospitals and admissions to hospitals, and also importantly, increased costs to the health service system. I think the CDC made a comment about it more recently about COPD and medication adherence, that if we were to have more adherence to medications, they would reduce the cost of COPD treatment by about 30% yearly. So I think it is a real problem. I think it does have consequence.
Grania, can you talk to us a little bit about reasons that people are not adherent? I mean, do people deliberately set out to not use their medication, or what happens? How do we get to a situation where, you know, someone like you or me sitting in a clinic room decides that our patient needs a certain medication and they end up agreeing to take it, but then don't?
You know, most people know that if they're given a medicine that they probably should use it, but they make a conscious decision not to. And they, despite knowing the best course of action for them, they make a different decision. And I think it's about trying to understand that. I think that arbitrarily we tend to decide that adherence or non-adherence is either intentional or unintentional, where we kind of describe intentional non-adherence as being this active decision not to follow instructions. So they'll be saying, you know, yes, doctor, yes, pharmacist, and they know fine rightly that they're not going to use it. Then there's this idea that some adherence or non-adherence, it's unintentional and they don't take the treatment regime for reasons beyond their control. Perhaps they forget, perhaps it's too complex, perhaps they can't pay for the treatment. And I think what we kind of know is that this kind of intentional non-adherence, that to me is the most difficult to find and the most difficult to attempt to remedy, it can be based on sort of the health psychology around necessities of medicines, whether people think that their disease is even controllable, whether they're more concerned about the side effects than the disease itself. And it's this very complex interplay amongst all the sort of ideas in people's heads as to what good medicine is and bad medicine, and trying to kind of put that all together. I think this kind of arbitrary sort of unintentional or intentional is a tricky one, because, you know, people are less likely to forget things they think are important. There's lots of reasons around kind of the background to it, and hopefully the paper that we've written has delved into that a little bit and how to identify those particular reasons and give some practical solutions on how to actually remedy them.
We've heard from the two of you that non-adherence to treatment in airways disease is both common and of clinical relevance. But in order to address it, presumably you first have to identify it. Gráinne, a lot of your background is in doing kind of old school detective work when it comes to this. So maybe you could expand a little bit about established methods of identifying adherence or measuring adherence to treatment in people with airways disease. And then we might ask Imran to talk a little bit about inhaler monitoring technologies.
So Imran's already mentioned some of the ways of detecting non-adherence, which are things like prescription refill rates. You know, I think it's a fairly blunt tool. You know, just because people pick up their prescriptions doesn't mean they take the inhaler, doesn't mean they take the inhaler appropriately. I think that is fairly blunt, but certainly if they aren't getting the inhalers, then they can't be taking them. So you do get some information from that. Just as a kind of an aside, you know, I'm obviously a full-time pharmacist, part-time detective, and there's no sort of Jedi mind games in this. I think that if you ask the right questions, occasionally people will be honest with you. There are two kind of phrases that come from patients that, you know, fill my heart with joy when I'm talking to them about their medicines. And the first one is always, you know, I didn't tell the doctor this, but, because usually what's about to come is that, you know, is a fairly crucial piece of information that has been, you know, is about to be passed on to me as the pharmacist and not the doctor. And I think that's really important because it shows the need for multidisciplinary working in this area, because actually not only do pharmacists and nurses and other healthcare professionals bring a different perspective, but also patients see us differently and they tell us different things. So we used to work together, Brian. You know, when I heard that phrase, I would gleefully go and report back whatever it was I'd managed to extract from the patient. I think the other thing is around when you're talking to people about their medicines, that the phrases, you know, nobody's ever explained it to me like that before. And I think what you've got to do is you try to understand what people's concerns are. What is it that they need from the medicine? What do they want? You know, because underlying all of this, patients are probably thinking, how little of this medicine can I get away with taking? And I think when you kind of delve into that and you explain to them why, you know, regular use might be important and things like that, I think that not only do you kind of break through some sort of myth in what they thought about the reasoning behind the medicines, but also it kind of gives a bit of an insight into perhaps they've started to trust you and that you sort of, you know, making it normal to sometimes not take your medicines, that you're not going to tell them off and you're not judging them. I think that that is a breakthrough around actually getting the answer. So not asking people, how often do you take it? Asking somebody, how often do you miss it? You know, you're normalizing it and you're trying to get the truth from people as opposed to kind of putting the thumb screws on, which I'm sure you think I do.
So there are some techniques for trying to drag the truth out of people. And I think one of the really interesting things about this, and it's a bit of an elephant in the room anytime we talk about adherence, is that the reason we need to think about these things is because people lie all the time. And we all probably do. Yeah. when we go to see our own doctors and, you know, we're asked about X, Y, or Z, we may not always give an unvarnished version of the truth. So if your interrogation methods fail, are there, and again, Imran will speak to inhaler monitoring technologies in a second, but maybe talk a little bit about some of the other techniques we have to actually objectively measure adherence. So I suppose I'm thinking particularly of phenosuppression testing.
The obvious one is phenosuppression testing and, you know, beautiful biomarker led understanding of differentiating those patients who are resistant to taking their ICS from those patients who are actually, you know, their asthma is resistant to the inhaled corticosteroids.
So I guess probably most people listening to this will have some familiarity with the concept of phenosuppression testing, but can you maybe just outline it in again, very briefly in two or three sentences?
Yeah, so you've got basically, you know, you have someone who will have observed inhaled corticosteroid. So they start off with a high pheno, you observe them having their inhaled corticosteroid, and that could be face-to-face or over Zoom, something like that, over a number of days, or it could be remotely. Using some of the technology Imran's going to come on to, and you then measure pheno after that. So you've got a measure of a good idea that they've been using the inhaler, and you compare the sort of pre and post measurement pheno. And if there's a significant decrease of sort of 40 to 50%, it does rather suggest that they weren't using their inhaler prior to that. So phenosuppression testing is not for everybody. You know, you have to have the high pheno to begin with. You have to have access to being able to observe patients, but it's a beautiful technique to identify non adherence. And I think the other one that you kind of mentioned earlier about your patient who had the steroids in their handbag, you know, obviously we can look at sort of cortisol, and you can look at that quadrant of the people who've got a suppressed cortisol and prednisolone present who would appear to be taking the maintenance steroids. You've got the patients who perhaps don't have prednisolone in their system but are suppressed cortisol and how we interpret that. And then there's the ones that probably get fast tracked to me, which have got a normal cortisol but have prednisolone in their system, and they probably just took a dose this morning to fill us. So I think there's something about trying to kind of piece it all together and work out whether it's a deliberate or an unintentional sort of non-adherence in the background. And I think the future is definitely going to be much more around electronic monitoring, because I think the other thing we're kind of focusing a lot on is around the detection of non-adherence. And I think that we want to spend more time on actually addressing it and less time in finding it.
Imran, could I ask you then maybe to pick up the story about how we monitor adherence using novel technologies, because you've done a lot of work in this area over the last decade or so.
Yeah, sure. And so Grania kind of mentioned some of the direct methods and some of the indirect methods that we used for measuring adherence. And like mean possession ratio or pharmacy refill records has always kind of been the standard that we've used previously. But one of the big problems with, you know, using that Grania alluded to earlier was that it's just whether the patient picked up their prescription. It doesn't tell me when the patient took their medications. And particularly for inhaled medication, it doesn't tell me how they took their medications. And similarly with, you know, with using drug levels for medications, that really doesn't tell me when the patient took their medication, you know, over a time period. It doesn't tell me how frequently they took it, et cetera, or how well they took it. So that, I think, led to the birth of the development of electronic monitors. And there have been electronic monitors in the past for pill counting, but really came to strength, I think, with the inhalers. The first kind of development of electronic monitors for inhalers were really focused at MDIs, specifically looking at when patients were taking their inhalers. So for MDIs, looking at the timing of actuation of the inhaler over a time period. With that data from those kind of electronic monitors, you are still doing this mean possession ratio, but you're getting the actual binary data of whether the inhaler was used, what time it was used over a period of time. The problem with those electronic monitors, and there've been several different ones for different inhalers through different companies, is that they're telling you part of the story for inhalers. They're telling you when the patient took their inhaler. And with some of the newer ones, I think Propeller Health has GPS monitoring on their device as well to tell you where the patient took their inhaler. But they just tell you that bit of information. They don't tell us how the patient took their inhaler. And some of the work I did looked at some of the common inhaler techniques that we in the clinic identify, such as poor inspiratory flow rate, or the order of the technique for the specific inhaler was completely wrong, and how they relate to drug delivery. And all of them, to some extent, cause some problems with delivery of inhaled medications. But really the one that stuck out for me in the work I've done is inspiratory flow rate, particularly with the dry powder inhalers. And so from that, we developed an electronic adherence monitor that actually can give us information about technique. And that device was the Inhaler Compliance Assessment, or INCA for short.
So what does that add in? How do you get some idea about technique on the basis of this? So what's the sort of underlying technological principle there?
What this device has that the others don't is that it built into the device is a microphone and a memory card. So similar to how I'm talking to you now through a microphone, that microphone turns on when the inhaler is opened and records audio of the patient using their inhaler. And so you can listen to every single audio file of the patient using their inhaler and identify inhaler techniques, errors, or good use. Or after doing that for several months, you develop an algorithm that can pick them up automatically and tell you whether it's being used appropriately or inappropriately.
I'd say they were a long few months, Imran, before the algorithm kicked in, were they?
It was a year, actually.
Who's counting? So tell us a little bit then about how that informs your care of the patients.
To go back to Grania's point about how you have this conversation with patients about adherence, you know, not a conversation of blame, or to go into the conversation open and positive. Involving the patient in this discussion is important. I find like having more data to share with your patient in an appointment, it just makes it so much easier to have this conversation. I'm sure, you know, this is applicable to other diseases that we, Brian and I, that we've seen, you know, similarly with obstructive sleep apnea. When I'm in the clinic with those patients, having data about the device that they use to show them and to talk through with them makes the conversation a lot easier.
I got to say that with some of the e-inhaler technology, there's a richness to that data that I think you find out so much about people from the INCA data. And it's just fascinating to see how people behave. You know, there's people who religiously take their inhaler at the same time every day, even when they go on holidays and you see this timestamp jet lag thing.
Yeah.
And then there's like these complete dilettantes who like have one shake of the damn thing in the car park before coming back in to see you in clinic. But, you know, so it's like, it really is, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I was going to bring that point up, you know, in relation to the story of the patient who's prednisolone tablets fell out of her handbag. I mean, we did a study where patients were told they were given a device that's recording them using their inhaler. And about three patients in that study didn't use their inhaler for the whole month, but the day before returning the device, actuated it 60 times before returning it to me. So the counter said zero, but I heard every single dose that they did. In that same study, that was a primary care study. Part of that work was feeding back to the general practitioners information about their patients and how they use their inhalers. And a couple of patients that we discussed with the GPs, you know, the GPs explained to us that they actually had a lot of stuff going on in their social life that explains some of their erratic inhaler use that, you know, I wasn't privy to when I was looking at the data. So again, like, I think it, you know, you're right. There is some richness to this data that allows for that conversation with the patients to be more informed. And I think they feel more involved with it because it is their data, you know.
Can I bring up the first of a couple of ethical considerations here? That's about who owns that data and where does the consent process begin and end? You know, obviously when people come in to see us in clinic, there's implied consent that they want treatment. But does that go so far as to following them around with a GPS marker on their propeller device?
Yeah, and I struggle with this. I had a conversation with a patient just last week. This is, again, a sleep patient, and we were going through his CPAP adherence data, and he got very upset because he said he did not consent to being monitored and didn't know that the machine was monitoring him use his device. And obviously, he didn't use it at all for the month prior to our conversation. You know, I had to explain it, that information is important for both myself and for him to understand his condition. And I think this is applicable similarly with inhalers and how we go forward with the treatment.
What can we do about it when they're not taking their inhalers? Gronia, maybe can you just outline sort of disease agnostic approaches that may have been developed in other spheres but can be applied to airways disease?
We do know that there are several interventions that appear to improve adherence. You know, things like supported self-management, tailored education around disease and medicines, you know, across the board, that seems to improve adherence for patients. I think if you provide treatment to people free of charge who would otherwise struggle to pay for it, I think that has an impact. And I think that, you know, that those kind of things, that they apply across the board. I think when you look again specifically at some of the respiratory airways disease, I think the concept that Imran has described around that real-time feedback for patients, it's interesting you're talking about consent. I mean, we are much less experienced with using in practice the kind of e-monitors and things that compared to Imran, but certainly we do consent our patients to participate with an e-monitoring sensor. The fact that the patients can access their own data and they can see when they've missed it, and we definitely sell it more as a kind of a supporting adherence in the longer term, moving forward, rather than a catching people out kind of tool.
So is there anything from, say, the psychology literature that shows an evidence to based approach to how we try and improve adherence?
I think that it's conflicting, and I think it's probably conflicting mostly because of kind of methodological limitations of some of these studies. Sometimes we make these interventions and actually, you know, we increase adherence in the control arm too, so then we don't really see the benefits. There is an inherent bias around, although not what Imran's just said, around kind of recruiting patients to an adherence-based study, you know, who are probably starting off with a baseline higher adherence than you would expect. But what we're looking at is, you know, we've got two kind of frameworks, broadly speaking. You know, we've got something called the COMB, which looks specifically at capabilities, opportunity, motivation. that produce a certain behavior, and we can apply that to medicines. We've got another kind of health psychology model based on necessities and concerns, which is the PAPA, which is the practicalities and perceptions approach, which again is where if you remove barriers to adherence and the patient is motivated to take their medicines, then they will. And that sounds very simple, but actually what you're doing is you're trying to identify what's the problem, implement a solution, and then actually in practice what then happens is a different problem presents itself, which is why we have to keep coming back to adherence over and over again. If we make a single intervention, the adherence then wanes. But certainly it's about this kind of systematic approach to identifying what the problem is, overcoming it, making sure that has had the effect, and that improvement in adherence then persists longer term.
Obviously, a large part of your role is in making sure that we can cut down on unintentional non-adherence by making sure that people can use their inhalers properly. Do you want to give us your favorite inhaler technique stories? Just pick one.
Pick one. I mean, I think this, I like this one because I think it kind of challenged my kind of jumping straight to what I saw as the solution rather than actually identifying the problem, which was a registrar coming to me in a clinic and saying, oh, I've got this patient who, isn't using their brown inhaler because it makes their mouth sore. And I kind of thought, okay, well, I know why this is, it's around sort of oral hygiene, et cetera, et cetera. But, stick to the script, identify, okay, please show me how you use your inhaler, et cetera, et cetera. And what they did was an MDI, they took the lid off, they shook it, and they put the whole thing in their mouth and they squeezed their cheeks. So basically what you've got is this kind of, people are told to put it in their mouth and actuate. And I think, instantly you're thinking to yourself, right, well, yep, I can see why that's making your mouth sore. Number two, you're thinking, well, at least there's plenty we can do to kind of improve your technique. You have to be optimistic about these things. So develop your poker face and, move on. And then, of course, the third thing, thinking, well, just as well, we didn't ask you to use a spacer. So I think there's something about, how you kind of, you don't jump to conclusions. You don't assume that, because of their gender or their age or anything about them, that you know what the problem is. You ask a few key questions, you probe a little bit, and it takes a little bit of time. And then you actually kind of tell them what you think the problem is, ask them what they think the solution is, and then you come to an agreement.
Imran, you've obviously had plenty of insight into people's inhaler technique from the INCA studies, but does having INCA or related technologies attached to your inhaler, does it change your adherence? And does that change your outcomes?
Before we go there, I might just add another funny story onto Grania's story. The funniest one I've had so far, I have to say. So for our COPD study, we sent out a fresh inhaler with an INCA device on it to the patients, and then they would send it back to us. So a lot of them were messy and covered with dry powder inhaler in the mouthpiece, but the best one was a cigarette stub on the inhaler.
So it's a novel approach to using one of the discus inhalers as an ashtray, but at least they're honest. Anyway, so INCA, does INCA can spot adherence, or e-monitoring can spot non-adherence, but can it modify non-adherence?
Like what Grania said, it's difficult to study this because particularly in asthma, all of us know that once a patient with asthma goes into a clinical trial, things change dramatically to what the real world is like. And so in the study that we did in an intervention study for inhaler adherence in asthma, patients came into the study with better than expected adherence. But in that study, so that was a randomized controlled trial where it was a one-to-one randomization where one group got standard care. But this is obviously standard care that isn't standard to a clinic appointment. They got a monthly visit with a nurse practitioner. That was the control arm. And then the active arm, in that visit, they got a download of their INCA data printed off, and we went through every day of the last 30 days when they used their inhaler and how they used their inhaler, and re-educated them about inhaler adherence. That, I guess, that's a biofeedback to the patient. And in that study, even though adherence was good in both groups, and even though adherence improved in both groups, the adherence was improved significantly more in the intervention arm. In a real world situation, this technology is effective in promoting adherence and proper inhaler technique.
I mean, in your studies, was that something that was associated with clinically meaningful improvements in either patient reported outcome measures or kind of more doctory focused, kind of harder endpoints?
The short answer to that is no. unfortunately, the problem with studies in asthma, similar to what I said earlier, patients who get enrolled into a clinical trial of asthma will get better. And so in that initial study, you know, everyone got better from whatever metric you want to use is what is better. And we used ACT and AQLQ for that study. There is a study that's just finishing here with the INCA group. The results of that might elude us a little bit more into, because this is a longer study, in terms of improvements in health questionnaires or asthma control.
I think your mention of clinical trials brings us to a really important point about adherence, which is that routinely we don't see systematic assessment of adherence to inhaler therapy in most big asthma RCTs. To what extent does this compromise the literature about, say, for example, biologic agents and other approaches to asthma therapy?
I find it hard to believe that it doesn't. You know, we see these placebo effects. We see that patients improving when they're in control arms, and we kind of explain it away. And I think that we do need to be much more robust, that when we say that non-adherence is an exclusion, or that an inclusion criteria is adherence to routine therapies, I think we need to mean that. When I looked back over some of the, I think it was specifically mepolizumab data, I looked at how many patients were excluded out of the thousands that were screened for inclusion in the trials. And there was something crazy like 3 patients who were excluded because of non-adherence. Now, either I've got the naughtiest patients in the world, or they didn't investigate properly, because I find that incredible. Less than 1% of their patients were non-adherent to their...
And I suppose for context on that front, we know that from your data from GUIDES, but also international data from Australia, from Joy Lee in Melbourne and from Italy as well, that at least 50% of people that we are considering for biologic agents are non-adherent to inhaler therapy at the point where we're considering them for biologic agents. And it seems a bit of a stretch to believe that magically selective group of people who always use their inhalers have ended up in these RCTs. Certainly looking at some of the big phase 3 studies, like some of them do jump out as maybe the placebo arm doing a bit better than they ought to have done with just placebo.
One of my colleagues here, she had done some work looking at some of the big RCTs in asthma and how they measured inhaler adherence prior to enrollment in the study. And what she found was that, so a lot of studies say they measure adherence, but they have no protocol for how they measure adherence. They don't report any data on adherence either. And then she actually went looking for protocols from the lead authors and got very little feedback. So, I think it is a big problem. Like, if we're saying that this is what we need to do before we, you know, that's another conversation we'll have, but before we go into treatment with these medications and they're not part of the clinical trials, then the data on those clinical trials is very biased.
Yeah, absolutely. If we're saying that the trials of asthma biologics have a degree of compromise because adherence wasn't properly looked at, what do we know about adherence in people who are on biologics? And what do we know about the effect of adherence on outcomes in these patients?
I guess what we're thinking about is we make assumptions of outcomes based on what we detect from the clinical trials. What we found in some of our work was that if the patient on mepolizumab, for example, stopped using their inhaled corticosteroid on treatment, they actually did worse. So it's not as though the biologics come along and they kind of supersede inhaled corticosteroids. This is an add-on treatment as per license. And if the patients then go on to develop non-adherence, then they will fail. You know, they will have more exacerbations, they will have more corticosteroids. And I think we need to be aware that this is something that is potentially a factor long-term.
Do you think there's differences between biologics? I mean, all of the available biologics at the moment target different aspects of type 2 inflammation in different points in the type 2 inflammatory cascade. And we know that, for example, the licensed dose of mepolizumab has different effects on airway eosinophilia compared to the licensed dose of rezlizumab or benralizumab. Do you think there might be a difference between how the biologics behave in that context?
I mean, when we looked at a sort of similar study, but for patients who were taking benralizumab At 1 year, the outcome did not seem to be affected by ICS adherence, which I think was a bit of a surprise to us. But clearly there are differences. They have different mechanisms of action. So we need to understand a little bit more about what treatment is needed. And that's being investigated. This was a retrospective cohort study. So I think what we are doing or what's happening now is a proper clinical RCT called Shamal that's looking at, you know, what is the optimal dose of inhaled corticosteroid on, say, benralizumab, and look at that in other biologics, because that's the important thing. Do you need any biologic or do you need the high dose? The high dose is more around the eligibility for the biologic. It's not necessarily moving forward. Absolutely the right thing to do.
That's an AZ-funded study looking at benralizumab, and it'll be, you would imagine that if any of the drugs that are either available now or coming down the line might be ones that you get away without inhaled steroids, then tezepelumab targeting TSLP would seem like a good candidate for potential. We'll have to find out whether it might be something that can be used as potential monotherapy in some people. But I guess we're way away from that yet.
Adherence to whatever treatment is a behavior, right? And I think understanding inhaler adherence and how it relates to other behaviors is important. I did an editorial on a paper from a group in the States who looked at inhaler adherence before and during biologic therapy. You know, what was interesting, and I think you guys found similar stuff, is that the patients that were adherent to their inhalers prior to starting biologic therapy were adherent to their inhaler therapy during biologic therapy, but were also more likely to present for their treatment for their biologic therapy as well. And I think, you know, that goes to that point that this behavior of good adherence is important that we understand for these add-on therapies.
I think you're right, Imran. I think it comes back to this idea also that the adherence or non-adherence specifically is unusual to find on its own. It is normally associated with, you know, sort of a bit chaotic lifestyle and non-adherence or turning up late to appointments and things like that. It's much more of a sort of a syndrome that's just one of the symptoms of lots of things going wrong. So I think you're absolutely right on that.
How do you think that's going to manifest itself as we move towards home care with these high-cost biologics? You know, the rheumatologists and the dermatologists and the gastroenterologists have been giving people their biologics at home for a long time. I guess we're just moving towards doing that now, and that's probably been accelerated by the pandemic. Gráinne, you've a lot of experience in managing biologics in people's houses. And what do you think is going to happen with adherence there? Is that going to become a problem for us?
I guess if you have a tendency to have not used your medicines in the past, there is a chance that you may revert back to that. Unfortunately, you know, the e-monitoring that we have of inhalers, we don't have access to something like that for the injections. My feeling is that when the patients start to feel better on the injections, some of them kind of tend to either, rather than not take it, they might take it a little bit sooner if they think that it's wearing off. They might take it a little bit later if they think they're fine. So I think there's a little bit of kind of patients hedging their bets. And that's not to say that's wrong, but I just hope that they tell us about it, because I think it's really interesting to understand that sort of bell-shaped curve of it doesn't necessarily have to be every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks, that people tweak it because naturally that's what people do.
I mentioned talking about a second ethical issue, and that's about access to biologics and whether that should be contingent on satisfactory, on what we deem satisfactory adherence to maintenance inhaler therapies. Do you feel that we should be effectively acting as gamekeepers to supervise access to biologics via stratification, like use of inhalers?
Any kind of rationing, as that's how it's perceived, does not sit well with clinicians. But, you know, I have to say that I do feel that in any economy where, you know, there are limited resources, I think we do need to do that. There are some people who, if they were to use their inhalers and routine treatments appropriately and effectively, they would be well controlled. You know, they do not need that biologic. There are the patients that, you know, potentially even when they do take their medicines, they're uncontrolled. And I think we do need to stratify that. And I think the work that we've shown that, you know, adherence to, say, the ICS on treatment, that actually affects your outcome, I think that gives us a little bit more, that's an easier conversation to have with the patients. So, for example, you know, I would never let the truth get in the way of a good story, but certainly I don't sell the kind of, you know, the eligibility criteria. I say that we're optimizing your treatment. We're maximizing your chance of responding to this biologic, because at least certainly within the NHS in the UK, you know, you have a 1 year window And at that year, if you haven't responded, then we're obliged to really to stop treatment. So you really want to make the most of that year. And that's how we sell it to kind of patients, that we're not saying no, we're saying maybe not yet. Let's get your inhaler and other treatment optimized so that we maximize your chance of responding.
Imran, any thoughts on to what extent we should be using inhaler adherence as a criterion for access to biologics?
That's a tough one. And, you know, I go both ways. I think, you know, the crux of it is that if the biologic therapies that we have access to were the same cost of inhalers, this wouldn't be a conversation. Pretty much everyone we see would be on biologic therapy. I think what measuring adherence and looking at inhaler adherence before starting biologic therapy has benefits, not as a gatekeeper to whether you get this drug or not, but it helps you develop that relationship with the patient that you might not have had before. It helps you understand their disease a little bit better as well, for like a couple of months of just monitoring them and seeing them regularly before you decide that this is the treatment that we're going to give you.
The other important thing is that it confirms your diagnosis for you.
We're notoriously terrible at diagnosing asthma, and it's not an easy diagnosis to make. And having a little bit of time with your patients, seeing how they use their inhaler, how their inhaler works or doesn't work for them, really helps me understand them better.
Do two of you ever feel comfortable with the idea that if you have a patient who is genuinely really unwell with their asthma and is presenting to the hospital on a frequent basis with exacerbations and may even ended up, you know, in ICU, but where you know that they're simply not using their maintenance inhalers. To what extent are either of you comfortable with the notion that they could be started on a biologic sort of as salvage therapy? Or do you think that's a misguided approach?
I'm always the bad news person, but, you know, I think that, you know, we do need to be pragmatic. So on the one hand, I'm not sure there's the kind of, you know, the mortality data to support saying, you know, if we don't do something, you know, it's going to be catastrophic. But then on the other hand, you know, life gets in the way of using treatments, and this shouldn't be a stick to beat people with. I think that if you've characterized the asthma as potentially responsive to a biologic and you've tried making interventions, then actually I think that with even sort of even within the NHS, who's very, very strict, I think there is that leeway to be able to work with someone on their adherence while initiating the biologic at the same time. From my experience, it's more difficult, I think, to get people to change their ways around adherence when they're on the treatment as opposed to before that incentive's gone. But I think that is possible. And I think it is a reasonable, pragmatic clinical decision to make.
No, I completely agree with you, Grania. I think adherence to any treatment is so complicated. There's so many factors going into whether a patient uses their medication, and then with inhalers, whether they're using it correctly. It's so complicated. If we try and we're not successful and the patient is a candidate for a biologic, I think it's more than reasonable to give them a trial of a biologic. The only caveat to that is bad behavior that continues will continue while they're on their treatment. So as you said, like, it'll be hard to fix their inhaler adherence. And then in some settings, their adherence to taking the biologic therapy might not be good either. But I don't think we should say, yeah, we tried, you didn't take your medication, so we're not giving you, you know, this potential medication.
That's great. Okay, I'd like to shift gears a little bit. There's a few different phrases that when I see them in the title of an article, they make me roll my eyes a little bit. Like, one of those is machine learning, because 90% of the time when you see a paper with machine learning in the title, it's essentially that someone's gotten a slightly smarter version of SPSS and pressed go and done some unsupervised regression models. The other one, I'm afraid, Imran, is the microbiome. But you're an expert in the microbiome. So I'd like you to tell us how the microbiome could be utilized to inform what we do about adherence. Could it be used as a marker of adherence? Or do we know anything about how adherence to treatment in airways disease influences the microbiome? Feel free to defend the microbiome as a concept while you're at it.
Yeah. My career in research started with the adherence and has somehow ended up in the world of the lung microbiome. The work that's been done in asthma has really been led by Yvonne. She's kind of the primary person who's done all the work in asthma. And a lot of this data that we know of now is really based on sputum microbiome data. I will say the caveat to that is that we know from loads of different papers that the lower airways microbiome tends to be different than sputum. It's just that obviously a sputum sample is a lot easier to get. But a lot of the focus on the asthma microbiome hasn't really been about adherence. It's really been about understanding the microbial diversity in asthma patients and how it affects their disease progression. Some of the interesting stuff that's been discussed recently is how different microbiome or microenvironments in asthma react to different biologic therapies, and whether we should look at that as, you know, a marker of who is a good candidate for which particular biologic based on their microenvironment. And then there's some recent discussion about the Th2 low patients, whether should I have not brought up that word?
Oh God, we'll come back to that. Go on.
Because we have all these amazing treatments for the Th2 high patients and nothing if there is Th2 low patients, but whether the microbiome would be somewhere that we could target for therapies, whether they're prebiotics or probiotics or a lung transplantation of the microbiome.
Presumably though, since we would expect that inhaled anti-inflammatory medication will influence host defenses, it will presumably also influence microbial diversity. Do we know anything yet about whether the microbiome changes according to how much inhaler you take? And if not, in the same way as we've put our skeptical hat on about biologic trials in severe asthma, because we don't know about adherence in those patients, should we also take a similar approach to some of the data we have about the microbiome in asthma? Because I'm guessing that a lot of the time, those papers won't have solid data on adherence.
There was a paper looking at, again, sputum microbiome, comparing different doses of inhaled corticosteroids, so low and high doses of inhaled corticosteroid. There was some signal. There was higher relative abundance of Haemophilus parainfluenza in those who are on a higher dose of inhaled corticosteroids. But what has been consistent in all asthma studies, regardless of the inhaler treatment you're on, there is a higher prevalence of Haemophilus species in general. Again, the caveat to that is that this is all sputum. We know from lower airway sampling that inhaled therapy does alter your microbiome. And so in any of the work that I've done looking at the lower airway microbiome, one of the exclusion factors I try to keep to is no inhaled corticosteroids prior to sampling.
Gronia, can you maybe tell us a little bit about what we know about the relationship between adherence and COVID? At the start of the pandemic, we were all terrified that this virus is going to kill all of our asthma patients. And thankfully, that hasn't really manifested as such. But have people changed how they behave? Have people with asthma changed how they use their inhalers?
Well, when you look at national prescribing and dispensing data, certainly in the UK, there was this huge spike in March of 2020, just around the time when the pandemic was announced by WHO, that, you know, a huge increase, like a 50% increase month on month for ICS collection, a sort of 35% increase in SABA collection. And what we kind of thought was that, you know, is this a reflection of a change in, say, physician behaviour? So, you know, doling out loads and loads of prescriptions and that's kind of led to a surge in that month? Or is this maybe a patient-initiated and potentially an adherence issue? So what we did was kind of looking at a cohort of people who had were diagnosed with asthma, about 1,100 people in primary care, to look and see how their prescription pickup rates had changed in the year prior to the pandemic and the year since. And what we found was that it didn't seem to be this kind of phenomena of hoarding where patients were requesting many more prescriptions than they normally would. So the people who were adherent prior to the pandemic continued. That was fairly flat when we looked at their prescription pickups. The surge, that peak, was found in the people who were non-adherent previously. So clearly, when the pandemic was announced and people thought, you know, my lungs are not 100%, I was told I had asthma, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, last week. I haven't picked up any inhalers, but I'm going to make sure I do it now. It did change the behaviours. Now, it has kind of seemed to have gone back to sort of previous non-adherent rates, but certainly it did change behaviours. and never want to miss an opportunity. I think, you know, to have the opportunity to now think, if people are interested in the respiratory health, we need to capitalize on that and say, you know, these are the benefits of maintaining your lung health and using your inhalers moving forward. So I can't say that was specifically asthma, that sort of the generic increase in prescriptions, but certainly when we looked at that cohort, it did seem to kind of boost some people's usage.
Were they stockpiling?
We don't think so. So we looked at, I mean, we don't know if they used them, obviously, but they certainly collected them. So when we looked at the patients who would have been designated as, say, less than 75% NPR prior to the pandemic, certainly significantly more of them then sort of bumped up into that the year following the pandemic of having optimal adherence. So their NPR actually increased over that year. So hopefully we're going to publish that shortly, but it's really interesting that suddenly people, you know, maybe they had insight into the principal trial that we didn't have, although that wasn't asthmatics. But, you know, I think there's something about people suddenly thinking, oh, well, if this is a respiratory virus, perhaps I should get my lungs in tip-top condition.
So all the work that you and Imran have done over the years in assessing and addressing adherence and a tiny microbial particle.
We just need some fear. That's what increases adherence, fear.
That's true. I mean, I have to say, you know, and it's something that's really struck me with the asthma community generally is that there's been so much focus on identifying non-adherence that I think maybe people are going to be, based on what we've seen with CPAP in sleep medicine, I think people are going to be in for a little bit of a shock at how difficult it can be to change adherence behaviors. And I think the two of you have illustrated that really nicely with some of this discussion. So with that, we'll wrap up today. Thank you both very much for your time. And hopefully we can do this again soon.
Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast. And thank you to Gráinne d'Ancona and Imran Suleiman for their contributions to this discussion. If you're interested in reading further on medicine's adherence in respiratory disease, the June 2021 edition of Breathe revolves around this theme and features contributions from Gráinne and other experts in the field. All new ERS podcasts can be found on the ERS Respiratory channel, each featuring discussion from experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine. Thank you for listening and take care.